This is Judaism Unbound, episode 46, How Hanukkah Explains Everything. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we are here today. It's the middle of Hanukkah, towards the end. And we are joined today by a special guest, Dr. Jay Eidelman, who is a historian and writer living in Vancouver, Canada. He's a lecturer in the Department of History at the University of British Columbia, where he teaches history of the Holocaust. But he's joining us today to talk about the history of Hanukkah and a theory that he's been developing of how Hanukkah explains everything. Before we welcome Jay, I just want to also mention two things. Number one, for those of you who haven't looked at it yet, we have a website that we've developed, www.judaismunbound.com/Hanukkah, and we're spelling it the New York Times way, H-A-N-U-K-K-A-H. So that's www.judaismunbound.com/Hanukkah. And that's a site where we've collected a lot of different ideas about Hanukkah, different ideas about ways to celebrate Hanukkah, and it's not too late to check it out and enjoy some of the interesting material on that site, including special drinks for every night of Hanukkah, a playlist of music, and all kinds of other good stuff. So we hope you'll head over there and check it out. It's going to be even more relevant, I think, after today's conversation. And the second thing that we just wanted to mention, it is December 30th today when this podcast is coming out. It's the end of the tax year, and we know that a lot of people like making their donations to worthy causes at the last minute of the tax year. The Institute for the Next Jewish Future, which is our parent organization, is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So any donations you make to support Judaism Unbound are tax deductible, and you will have our undying gratitude for helping us out with a generous end of year donation, or perhaps by also signing up to make a regular monthly donation in 2017, which you can do at our website, www.judaismunbound.com/donate. So thank you very much. And with that, let's go into our conversation about how Hanukkah explains everything. Jay, that's a very intriguing topic, and we're so glad to welcome you to Judaism Unbound.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
So when I was first told about you by a mutual friend, she described it as you having a theory of how Hanukkah explains everything. And so I was wondering if you could just sort of tell us the story of how you came to develop this theory, and then we can jump into what it's all about.
Great. So about 3 years, my dad died about 3.5 years ago, and I started going to synagogue every day to say Kaddish for him. And, you know, traditionally you go for 11 months. So I was going every day, and I would be there most Saturdays, or at least for most of Saturday, for Shabbat in synagogue, and I was hearing the Torah. Now, I have a background in Jewish studies, and I went to a Jewish day school, so I was familiar with a lot of the Tanakh, the Torah, but hearing it week to week, I started to see patterns, especially related to the book of Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the five books of Moses, which has a very interesting story in and of itself. And you also listen to the prophets, the Haftarah, and seeing the connections between those two and how they come together, how they're contrasted, reading the commentary in the Chumash, in the translation that we use during the reading. And then about a year ago, we were having a retreat from the synagogue, and it was, you know, November, so it was a month before Hanukkah, and I was asked to do a talk, and I said, oh, I have a great talk about Hanukkah, how Hanukkah explains everything. Of course, I hadn't written anything, and I just said, yeah, I know the historic Hanukkah, and I'll make it funny. You know, it's how it'll be a universal theory of everything related to Hanukkah. But when I started working on it, it really did seem like, wow, you know, this Hanukkah story is more important than most people give it credit for, because a lot of, especially Jewish professionals, people in Jewish education, they want to minimize Hanukkah because it's often seen as Jewish Christmas. So they want to make the differentiation between the two. But I saw it as really, it's not really a minor festival in a lot of ways. It's actually really important. And in many ways, it gets right to the heart of what Judaism is, and in some ways, what it means to be Jewish. I guess I was having these epiphanies and I was saying, wow, you know, I never thought about Hanukkah like that. You know, the candles and latkes or playing dreidel or getting Hanukkah gelt. The holiday itself, that the way it was practiced in my house, the way it's practiced in my, you know, as a kid, the way it's practiced in my house now, it was a really kind of minor thing because we didn't say it was Christmas and we didn't overdo it on the presents. I used to get a couple of bucks from my parents, from my grandfather, but it was really more focused on lighting the candles, getting together with family and friends, and things like that. It was very much ritual in the home, but I started to see a much deeper message and history of Hanukkah.
All right, well, we're excited. So could you start to walk us through it?
To start with how Hanukkah explains everything, we have to ask a question that the early sages, the rabbis, don't really ask. So if you go to the Mishnah, which is an initial commentary on the Bible and lays down a lot of the rules and rituals for Judaism, it's compiled in the second century by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Judah the Prince. There's a lot of passages that ask, what is this? What is that? But they never ask, what is Hanukkah? So, you know, is it, I'll give you a multiple choice test. Is it a tale of a plucky band of freedom fighters who battle forces much larger than themselves to win liberty? A. B. Is it a story of a civil war in which religious zealots use murder and terror to impose their beliefs on their neighbors? C. Is it a saga of political intrigue that played out over decades, eventually involving the greatest powers in the region? Or D. Is it a winter solstice celebration of Eastern origin that eventually gained new meaning? Now, the rabbis never tell us in the Mishnah, and the Mishnah is mostly silent about Hanukkah, for several reasons. But if you picked any of these, you might be right, because what Hanukkah is depends on who you ask. So here's a rundown of the facts. Many people know this, many Jews know this, but I think it's still instructive to go through them. So in 198 BCE, the Seleucid Empire was under the leadership of Antiochus III, also known as Antiochus the Great or Antiochus Megas. And he's not the Antiochus or the Antiochus of the Hanukkah story. He's a predecessor. And he defeated the Egyptian Ptolemaic Empire and established hegemony in all of Asia Minor and the Levant, parts of Mesopotamia, parts of and Persia, as far east as the western reaches of India. Now, these Hellenistic empires extended Greek culture through the region, including, in a limited fashion, the political institution of what's called the polis, a city-state ruled by its citizens. Since the time of Alexander the Great's conquest of the land of Israel in 332 BCE, through Ptolemaic control and under Antiochus III's rule, Jerusalem operated not as a polis, but as a tetrarchy. So it wasn't quite the same as some of the other cities, but it had political autonomy to run its own affairs. Jews were more or less happy to live under this imperial control, as long as it only meant paying taxes and being left alone to run their own affairs. Now, what happened is that Antiochus III died in 187 BCE, in what's today known as Iran. And he left behind him a debt to Rome of 15,000 talents or 450,000 kilograms of silver. Now, I only know what that approximate value is in Canadian dollars because I live in Vancouver and I calculate it that way. But it was about 300 million. So even if you look at that in U.S., it's over 200 million U.S. dollars worth of silver at this time. And he had, and his successor, named Seleucus the IV, had to repay it. If you know things about the ancient Near East, the temple in Jerusalem was not only a sacred space, but it was also a kind of bank. It's where people stored their riches, and it was an important location for economic affairs. Seleucus wants the temple because he needs the money, and he sends a guy named Heliodorus to collect it in 178, and Heliodorus comes back from Jerusalem, and he kills Seleucus. So Seleucus's sons, his son Demetrius, was a hostage in Rome, and in 175, his younger brother Mithridates takes the throne and renames himself Antiochus IV Epiphanes, which I think Greek for "in whom God is manifest."
You mentioned Epiphanes before in your own discussion. That's the same word.
Yeah, that's the same. So before him, Ptolemy V Epiphanes was also in God, in whom God is manifest. So set up not only as a temporal ruler, but as a kind of demigod, I guess. When Antiochus comes to the throne, Jews are largely pro-Seleucid. So that's in 175 BCE. But the high priestly family, and remember the high priest was the tetrarch, so the high priest was in charge or was the political ruler as well as the spiritual ruler. And the family of the high priest was split by a rivalry between a man named Jason and another man named Menelaus. Notice already that the Jews have taken Greek names. There is an interest in Hellenistic culture already. It's very popular throughout the ancient Near East and not just amongst Jews. So Jason offers Antiochus a large sum of money to be made high priest. And he also pays for permission to make Jerusalem a polis, right? Because Antiochus, they still need the money. Empires need the money. Menelaus is supported by a group of wealthy landowners known as the Tabaiads, so the landed gentry. And they depose Jason by offering Antiochus even more money for the post of high priest. So, you know, it's not a new story. You know, if in Ecclesiastes, if the author is saying there's nothing new under the sun, is saying it back then, you know that by now there's really nothing new under the sun. Anyway, Antiochus invades Egypt in 169, and he's forced to withdraw a year later by the Romans. Jason thinks Antiochus is dead, and he attacks Menelaus. Antiochus thinks he has a civil war on his back. He drives Jason out of Jerusalem. Antiochus plunders the temple. He introduces measures to pacify the Egyptian border, and he imposes complete Hellenization. And that means the Jewish Book of the Law, the five books of Moses were prohibited, as was circumcision. And then on the 15th of Kislev, this month, the month that Hanukkah takes place in 167 BCE, we learn that an abomination of desolation, and that probably means a Greek altar, was introduced into the temple in Jerusalem. So the Jewish religion, or what's going to become the Jewish religion, depending on who you ask, was under threat, and a resistance movement springs up, and it's led by the Maccabee brothers, the Hasmoneans. And over the next 3 years, it wins sufficient number of victories over Antiochus to take back and purify the temple.
I'm struck at how what you just told as the backstory of Hanukkah is not what I heard as a 5-year-old in Sunday school. It's not what I heard as a 10-year-old in Sunday school. It's not what I heard as a 15-year-old as I got ready for confirmation. It's not what I heard anywhere in my Jewish educational experience, because of what you alluded to before, partially that we've sort of pushed Hanukkah aside as no, it's a minor holiday. How dare you elevate it? You're just assimilating to be like Christmas. And the other piece, which is that the meanings we do ascribe to Hanukkah are not so much about the historical events or even the Book of Maccabees. They're much more about understandings that come much later, whether it's the miracle of the oil or even just the family gathering, lighting the Chanukiah, you know, the sides of the holiday that we don't think of as much religious and more family-oriented, communally-oriented, so that I've actually never, at least in that much depth, been exposed to that story, and I'm somebody who's reading about Jewish stuff all the time. So I guess I'm curious to hear your thoughts on other elements of what we currently think of as Hanukkah, and then reflecting back to the story, why that story you just told, which is riveting, I was on the edge of my seat, isn't as much a part of our story of Hanukkah.
So yeah, all that stuff, as you said, it's all after the fact. It's all an interpretation of Hanukkah, of what really happened. I think it's an interpretation of Hanukkah for a couple of reasons. One reason is the disaster that took place when the Maccabees, the Hasmonean family, the Hasmoneans, became the rulers of Judea. And it was a complete disaster. When the rabbis look back, they say, oh my God, it's terrible what they did. They wrecked it. They lost us any sovereignty. That's why, you know, they are the beginning of the end, that ends with the destruction of the temple in 70. So when the rabbis are looking back 200, 300, 600 years later, they're saying, oi, this is the word. Well, they didn't say oi, but the Aramaic and equivalent of oi. They're saying, you know, this is a complete disaster, but they have to give some meaning to this holiday because it was already starting to be celebrated. The other reason is the rabbis can't help but interpret Hanukkah in its miraculous form because of the... they're reading a tradition of Jewish life that, or emerging Jewish life, that's really focused on these mitzvot. So when we get to the Gemara, when we get to the other half of the Talmud, the commentary on the Mishnah that's done several hundred years later, they do ask what Hanukkah is. And that's where we get the story. There's the disagreement between Shammai and Hillel that how do you light the Hanukkah menorah? Do you light it one candle, add a candle each day, or do you light it, as Shammai said, eight the first day and then you go down? And we get the reason for the candles, and which is the miracle of the oil, etc., etc. But really, the earlier commentators, the earlier people talking about Hanukkah in various sources, they give a completely different take on it. Josephus says, well, they had this holiday called lights. And he says, I suppose they called it lights because they were celebrating their liberty. But if we look at it, and I can talk about more about that, but if we look at it, it's really, there was a winter solstice festival, and many people know about this, that existed in the ancient Near East. And now we have it in all kinds of religions because it was in the Assyrian Empire. And so we have it, we have Diwali. Here in Vancouver, there's a huge Sikh and Indian community. So Diwali is enormous. Hanukkah, Christmas, all kinds of festivals of light that all happen around this time, which is midwinter, and it's the darkest time of the year, and it's also the beginning of our march towards spring. So on that level, if you answer D to my questionnaire up front, you got it right, because it's a midwinter festival that was common to everybody, and that the Jews probably either picked up in the land of Israel, or certainly picked up and started celebrating it in Babylon during the first first exile, quote unquote.
Well, I've had a theory. I mean, I guess I have two theories of the historical Hanukkah, and I don't know if there's direct evidence of either, but it has the feeling of truth to me. You know, it's as Stephen Colbert talks about.
Truthiness. You got truthiness. Right.
That the, it seems, right, that the Maccabees were much more fundamentalist. And, you know, it's sort of, I imagine, just in sort of thinking about how fundamentalists act in our time, and I think have always acted, that there are these Judeans who had brought the celebration of the Babylonian solstice festival back into the land of Israel when they returned from the Babylonian exile. And I suspect they were celebrating it the way that we American Jews celebrate Thanksgiving today. It's we're Jews, and this is another holiday, and we don't celebrate it for any Jewish reason. We celebrate it in addition to our Jewish celebrations, and it doesn't take away from it. It doesn't contribute to it. It's simply another holiday that we celebrate. And I think a lot of Jews think that's perfectly fine, same way that maybe we also celebrate Halloween and other holidays that way. And yet there are some Jewish fundamentalists and less than fundamentalists, I mean, just very religious Jews that will look at that, and some will say you shouldn't be celebrating it at all. Certainly, I've heard that for Halloween more so than Thanksgiving. And you think, like, well, when those Jews come to power, as the Hasmoneans did, then what would be the natural thing to do? There would be two choices. One is to say, you're not allowed to celebrate that festival anymore. And the other possibility would just be to say, let's find a way to give that festival a Jewish meaning, so that people, because obviously people want to keep celebrating that festival, but now we'll tell them that they're not celebrating it because it's the Babylonian Winter Solstice Festival anymore. They're celebrating it because this was the day of the temple's rededication. So I kind of wonder whether, you know, that was going on at the time of the Maccabees, and that really, you know, unlike what we often, I think, stereotypically think about Hanukkah, that, hey, it was this holiday that was originally celebrating the fight against assimilation, and now here in America, we're doing it violence by almost turning it into an assimilatory holiday because it's basically the Jewish Christmas. No, in fact, the actual origin of Hanukkah was assimilatory, and it passed through this effort to try to Judaize it, and now we're just sort of back to its origins.
Yeah, I think I agree with a lot of that. This Akkadian or Sumerian or Assyrian religion really influenced almost all of, all of the entire area from the Mediterranean into India, and influenced a lot of contemporary religion through the way these holidays were reinterpreted. I would ask a question. I said, what do you think is the most important moment of crisis in Jewish history for the development of Judaism? And I wonder what you'd answer to that.
I'm struggling to choose one because, I mean, we've talked about various crises on our show over time. I think one of the classic answers, and we've spoken about this one, is the destruction of the Second Temple. That's one that that frequently is pointed to as, you know, the end of one era, the end of our period with the temple as a centralized structure of where Israelite religion happens and the beginning of Rabbinic Judaism. I think that is possibly an answer. There's also some great pushback. Some people say that the Bar Kokhba revolt was actually the bigger turning point in that era, which happened about 50 years later or so. I'm not sure that either of those is my answer. I actually think, and this is part of what Dan and I are talking about, that this isn't a moment, but the set of trends that happened, let's approximately say, starting with the Enlightenment, through emancipations of Jews in a variety of different countries, through approximately, we'll say, the Holocaust, that period of a couple hundred years may be as significant a shift. That's a sort of a non-answer. I gave a bunch of answers, but that's my ambiguous way of answering.
That's very Jewish and also very academic.
From my perspective, it's the destruction of the Northern Kingdom, I think, was an important thing that we don't focus on enough. And then for me, the the turning point in the transition from Second Temple Judaism to Rabbinic Judaism is not the destruction of the Second Temple, it's the introduction of Hellenism. It's the invasion of Alexander the Great. Because I think that's where, like, I draw the connection to the Enlightenment, because I think that and maybe this is the academic intellectual sort of approach, right? But to me, the real disruptive force was not a physical destruction, it was an intellectual disruption.
I'm very pleased, but I'm also a little bit surprised that Dan got the right answer, or at least Dan got the answer that I wanted, which, you know, so you'd get 10 out of 10 on the exam, whereas Lex, you'd only get probably 8.5 out
Darn
of 10.
It.
Because, sorry, on the quiz. Well, I don't know. I mean, most people will answer things like the destruction of the Second Temple or the Holocaust. Those are usually the answers you get to that question. You know, whether you're talking about contemporary Judaism or Rabbinic Judaism, you'll get a different set of questions, the Bar Kokhba revolt, whether you're talking in academic terms about the sister religions theory, where you have these two religions that are sort of Christianity and Judaism that kind of develop in tandem and then split off from each other, which is, I think, somewhat discredited now, or there are arguments against that. But I really like the destruction of the First Kingdom, which is the exile of the Northern Kingdom, rather than Northern Kingdom, which is 500 years before the destruction of the First Temple. So, you know, the Solomon's kingdom splits between North and South, Israel in the North and Judah in the South. And in about 722 BCE, the northern tribes are exiled by Sargon II of Assyria. And during that exile, some refugees flee to the south, to Judah, and they bring with them, at least the theory goes, a form of Israelite religion that was known in the south, but wasn't as popular, and they helped popularize it. And this religion focused on a covenant with a most supreme form of God that was known, you know, by the Tetragrammaton, the ineffable name that in scholarship we use it called Yahweh. It's a covenantal religion. So if you don't do X, you don't get Y. If you're not true to this God, this Yahweh, you're going to have trouble. It's not going to rain. The crops will fail, you have to be really what we'd say today machmir. You have to be really observant, or you're in trouble. At the same time as this kind of very strict understanding of what are going to become the mitzvot, there is sort of hand in hand a prophetic vision. Where you have, and that's already starting in Deuteronomy, where you have to think about, you know, how do you treat the stranger, and how do you deal with issues of rich and poor, and social, what we'd call today social justice. All that stuff is happening at the same time. And I think, personally, and from what my reading is, where you see it again when you get to the Hanukkah story is, there's a socio-political event happening. On the one hand, you have these landowners who are the billionaires, you know, of their time, and they're running the show. And you have a political class, which is kind of the priests. And then you have the rest of the people who are in various conditions of either poverty or what we might call working poverty. Well, they're all working, you know, working poor, and some are a little better off. They're sort of in the middle, but there isn't the same kind of economic mobility as there at least was for the past half century. That's disappearing. There isn't as much, but there wasn't this opportunity to necessarily move up the economic ladder. So how do you deal with that conflict? I'm reading a book by, I think his last name is Harari, called Sapiens.
We're big fans of it.
You know, it's I like that kind of history where, hey, this is my idea and it explains everything. Hence, you know, Hanukkah explains everything. I really like that big, broad history. This idea that, you know, if you look at the conflict in a society, in a culture, that's where you're going to see what the culture is really about. And so with the beginnings of Jewish culture, you know, reading that book, I start saying, yeah, you know, there's this real tug of war between, and we experience it today. I'm always upset by this issue, is like, who speaks for the Jewish community? And it ends up being the people who can donate to the various institutions. So it's still the wealthy. And, you know, and then there's us, most of us, who are somewhere below that, who, you know, we want to be involved in the Jewish community. And we have to sort of, since we don't have the $1 million to donate, we just kind of got to take it. And there is that tension there. And it's sort of always been there.
So I'm really intrigued by this, mostly because what you're getting at, I think, as you talk about the landowner, as you talk about the historical class divides that the story of Hanukkah that you just outlined helps to teach us, what I think you're getting at is something that Dan and I have been talking about a great deal, which is, so what are some other meanings that Hanukkah could sort of take on that are not already a part of Hanukkah in a world where some of the other long-held traditions might not hold as much sway? So as an example, the kinds, so just as the rabbis were uncomfortable with a narrative for Hanukkah that elevated a group of people that they thought were poor leaders, and so they started to implement their own meanings, how can we, in a time where perhaps the miracle elements of Hanukkah are resonating with fewer people, how can we look to find new meanings? And I'm really struck by this class divide that you're bringing up, because I've never thought about that in connection to Hanukkah at all, but it's such a tangible, important message that just about everybody in the United States certainly is thinking about. We don't all agree about what to do with these questions of, I mean, you mentioned billionaires. Bernie Sanders, of course, made the discussion of millionaires and billionaires center stage in his presidential campaign. But I think that the idea that Hanukkah would take on the meaning of class struggle is something I never would have thought of, but that as you explain the backstory and a little bit of the prehistory before just, you know, starting with the revolt, it actually makes a lot of sense.
I guess what I'd say that the question of Hanukkah for our time is that it, I really see it as a historian, right? I'm happy to do the mitzvot of the candles, and I like eating latkes, and who doesn't like donuts? It is, for us, Hanukkah helps us recognize that Judaism has always had this diaspora component, that like all the other religions, Christianity, Islam, various other streams of culture that came out of that world, there is a deep connection to that Babylonian empire, which we might want to dismiss because, and not just Jews, we might want to dismiss it because we don't want to say, we want to say, hey, we invented it, right? And then there's this political aspect of Hanukkah that I think we have to bear in mind, that when we're lighting the candles, that's great, but Hanukkah is really telling us a story, teaching us, providing us with an allegory that's very, very pertinent for our own time, both in the politics of Israel, of the state of Israel, and in American politics, Canadian politics. One of my friends, a professor at the business school here, he says, well, we're having our Obama moment with Justin Trudeau. So, you know, our Trump moment is going to come, you know, in a few years. I'm like, dude, really? You know, you're bringing me down. We're sitting at Kiddush lunch in the synagogue. I said, man, you're bringing me down.
Well, you know, I was thinking about on the politics, I was... as you were talking, this is earlier when you were describing the origin story as beginning with this kind of two factions fighting over who is going to best please this new king that has arisen, you know. And I don't know if you meant it this way, but what struck me was that in a lot of the things that I've read over the last few weeks since the election of Donald Trump has been making an analogy between Trump and the Purim story. You know, the idea that Trump is Ahasuerus and Steve Bannon is Haman, and, you know, maybe Ivanka is Queen Esther, who knows? But you know, this whole sort of attempt to sort of put it into the Purim story. And it strikes me, though, that in an interesting way, maybe it sort of maps onto the Hanukkah story in that, and here I mean from a narrowly Jewish standpoint, because Lex and I talked about this a few weeks ago when we talked about, you know, sort of what is the response of the Jewish community to the election of Donald Trump, and what is that, the implications of that likely to be on Jewish organizations, because the election statistics show that Jews overwhelmingly voted for Hillary Clinton, and yet the major Jewish organizations, for the most part, congratulated Trump on his victory and look to try to figure out a way to positively work with him for all sorts of institutional reasons that are understandable, but yet probably don't register very well on those regular Jews who so passionately voted against him. And so it makes me think of what you were describing as these two factions who are trying to buy the high priesthood, you know, and we're trying to figure out who could give more money to the new king, you know, and ultimately the Maccabees, who I've never actually been very sympathetic to, because I've seen them as, you know, fundamentalists who stood for a kind of Judaism that wouldn't have been for me. But to look at the Maccabees allegorically as I think they essentially were, which were the salt of the earth. They were from outside of Jerusalem. They were of the people, right? And they were basically saying, a pox on both your houses. And this was essentially a people's revolution that not only ended up fighting against the foreign power, but also essentially displaced both political parties that were involved at that time. And it's striking to think about, you know, Lex and I have been talking a lot about how might the Jewish holidays be reinterpreted over time in our time to fit better with things that we've been that really are more relevant to Jews today. And, you know, a lot of times what's been coming up is this question of assimilation or non-assimilation. And this idea, we talked a few weeks ago with Bert Vysotsky from JTS to talk about, well, you know, one of the things that came up, at least that we brought up, was that, hey, maybe we should do a Seder for Hanukkah where we really struggle with this question of how much should we assimilate and whatnot. But in this conversation, it's really landing on me that for the first time that, wow, Hanukkah might actually represent an important allegory for the political times in which we live that might even find a deeper resonance with the regular American Jews who really want to have nothing to do with Trump, looking at their organizations who are saying, no, we have to find a way to work with him. And maybe Hanukkah becomes the rallying holiday of a Jewish people's revolution against the Jewish establishment.
Yes, that is exactly what I meant. No, I'm just kidding. That was excellent. But I did look at, to get closer to the Purim story versus the Hanukkah story, Dan, you know that the University of Chicago has the famous academic debate, the Latke versus Hamintash debate, which they've been doing since 1946. And of course, it happens at other places now, and no answer has been given which is better. We all know it's the Latkes, even though I like Hamintashen. But there is a tension between Purim and Hanukkah, and it's real, and you can look at it if you compare the book of Esther and Daniel. So Esther took form about 200 years before the Maccabean revolt, and Esther, acculturation and intermarriage are not seen as existential crises. The heroes find a place in the Persian court. They're able to influence events in favor of the Jewish survival against this terrible, implacable enemy, this Haman. And in Esther 8, verses 1 and 2, you read, that day King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman, the persecutor of the Jews. Mordecai came before the king because Esther had revealed their relationship. The king removed the ring he had given Haman and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther put Mordecai in charge of Haman's house. So, you know, this, the triumph is in Esther, it's a triumph of really being connected, being intermixed and intermingled. You know, the rabbis have all kinds of discussions about Esther and Mordecai. Are they, we call them uncle and niece, but really, you know, they're, we call them cousins, but they're really uncle and niece. So maybe they were married, and that's sort of a retelling in some ways of the story of Abraham and Sarah, who says when they go into Egypt. We just read that in November, I believe, in the annual reading. You know, he sends it to Egypt. And he says, "Well, don't say you're my wife. Say you're my sister, because if you're my wife, you the rabbis teach you they'll kill you." And then, of course, he reveals your wife, and the Egyptians say, "What? Why didn't you tell us she's your wife?" You know, and they give him all kinds of golds and riches because they don't want to, you know, because as the owner of his wife's modesty, I don't know what you'd call it, it would be a grave violation to, of course, take her as a wife or concubine because she's already taken. So current scholarship denies Esther as a historical work, and it's suggested that the author was writing a historical novella to explain the origins of Purim. But I think it offers a reading of diaspora life, which by the 4th century BCE was a common feature of Jewish experience, and it reflects a precarious nature of diaspora life and offers hope that you can live a fully Jewish life in exile, quote unquote. Now, if you go to the book of Daniel, which is set in Babylon prior to the events of Esther, but was likely composed after Esther during the time of Antiochus IV's repression of Jewish life. So in Daniel, which is really written in a contemporary period in chapter 8, he has the vision of the ram with two horns. And in verse 11, you can read, "It," meaning the ram, "set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord. It took away the daily sacrifice of the Lord, and his sanctuary was thrown down." And then Daniel continues in an apocalyptic vein. He says, "How long will the army of heaven and the temple be trampled upon? I heard the other angel answer, 'It will continue for 2,300 evenings and mornings, during which sacrifices will not be offered. Then the temple would be destroyed.'" Excuse me, "The temple will be restored." I think I might have said destroyed. I misspoke. That's in Daniel 8. They have an end times prediction that offers relief to the political and spiritual crisis afflicting the people contemporary. Even though it's set in Babylon, it's really about the story of Hanukkah. So you have that tension again. And we still have that tension. When I started looking at Hanukkah seriously in relation to what I had been hearing in the synagogue and really thinking about for the first time as an adult, as someone with a little experience of the world and not as a kid in Jewish day school, I started seeing that, wow, we're reading back into history, and the rabbis were reading back into history what they wanted to see in that history. And maybe by looking at it in its reality, in its historical roots, we get a better understanding. Hanukkah, if anything, is more meaningful for me now than it was as a kid, and even as an adult with my own kids, just thinking about the miracle of Hanukkah and saying Al Hanisim, you know, "Thank you for the miracles that you performed for us in the time of the Maccabees." I'm seeing it with a lot greater depth and a lot more meaning for me as a human being, as a political entity, as a political being, and as a Jew in the 21st century.
We had an interview that We haven't actually posted yet, but where the guest talked about how a lot is going to really have to change in Judaism, because now around our Pesach table, unlike in the past, most of the people are adults rather than the majority of people being children. And I think it's really important and critical for us to be able as adults to look again at these holidays and look at them with all the depth and with all the scholarship that we have available to us, and to be able to reinterpret them and remake them in ways that work for our times.
Following up or related to that, not only are we going to have fewer kids at the table, at least outside of the Orthodox Haredi world, we're going to have fewer kids at the table, but we're also going to have fewer millionaires, right? The economic mobility issue means that I'm not going to be a millionaire. I mean, sometimes I wish it were so, but it's probably not going to happen. Even in Canadian dollars, but I'm not going to be giving millions of dollars to build this building or that building or fund this program or that program. As the economic mobility, which, you know, Jews historically have had more mobility, social mobility than other groups, because you could always rise in the ranks through study, right? You could always, there was always a bit of a meritocracy in Judaism. As the number of people with real money diminish, who's going to pay for everything and who's going to have the say? So there are going to be fewer people at the table who are going to have a bigger say about things. And that's also the story of Hanukkah, as we said. I mean, I think that's a real lesson that we have to think about when we get together to light the candles, and also when we get together at the Pesach Seder.
Well, thanks so much for being on with us today. It was really a pleasure to have you. So enlightening, and we're really looking forward to mulling all this over and figuring out where it takes us.
Thank you for asking me. You're welcome, and thank you for asking me. It's been a pleasure talking with you. It was a delight. And for all of you out there, listen to the podcast.
You heard the man. Listen to the podcast. That's the moral of today's episode. No, the real moral of today's episode, as the title suggests, is that Hanukkah explains everything. And we once again thank Jay Eidelman for coming on to explain why that is. We want to close out, as we always do, by encouraging our listeners to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can always reach out to us on Facebook at our page that's just called Judaism Unbound. You can visit our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can send us emails at lex@nextjewishfuture.org or dan@nextjewishfuture.org. And the other plug we like to make at the end of episodes is that you can always support us with a small or large donation. And the way for you to do that is to visit judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks again for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.